Welcome to another special bonus edition of the Paul Ryder Tapes. I'm Angela Smith. I'm the ex-wife of founding member and bassist of Happy Mondays, Paul Ryder, who sadly passed away suddenly in July of 2022. In the months leading up to his death, he sat down with me to tell his complete life story. And then I talked to his inner circle of friends and family, gathering stories and details of his life that have never before been heard. Every single person in this series is someone who was genuinely an important part of Paul's life. There were no so-called experts pontificating or dialogue pundits spouting platitudes, just real people from his inner circle who were happy to share their thoughts. I've used lots of clips of the interviews in the main series, but everybody wanted to know all of the details, so these bonus episodes are those interviews in full. And this week's episode features two of Paul's closest friends who witnessed the very worst of times with Paul when he was really struggling with heroin. We're about to share some really sad memories as well as some stories and laughs from the later, much happier times. I'm very excited to introduce David and Maureen Brittell, who are better known by Paul as Disco Dave and Second Line Mo. Dave first got to know Paul in the 90s, and he remembers a day when Paul and Gaz were doing a music production course just before the Mondays reformed in 1999.
When Paul and Gaz were doing that production thing, I met them once. Yeah. They were in, I think it was in Hume, in some kind of studio, and they were down there, and I went to meet them to have some dinner. And Paul said, oh, I can't wait for this afternoon. I said, why? And he goes, oh, it's that one where we find out whether the bass can make you shit if it goes, like, dead low, the sound of it. And this was, like, his whole thing about the course was trying to see if he can make his bass make people shit. You can imagine it, a Monday's gig, you know, for a laugh. You know, 5,000 people shitting everywhere. Well, my name's David. Paul used to call me Disco Dave, which you know the story about that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my mates and Paul's mates have just been friends forever. And in fact, our kid used to work on the post with Paul. So we've always crossed each other. And then in the 90s, we've got to know each other pretty well and pretty much hung around for a couple of decades then and did various things. And Linda and Derek lived not too far from where we were living. We used to go around there and take him for a drink on a Sunday. Sounds like he's some kind of academic, but Derek used to give him his spends on a Sunday and we used to go for a drink. And that's how I know Paul.
Yeah, and I'm Mo, as you know. And it was through David that I got to know Paul, got introduced. He was living in Lynn or somewhere when I first knew him, just before he went to live with Linda and Derek. And yeah, we've just known him ever since.
Yeah, and crucially, you're married to Dave.
Yes, sorry, yeah. Should have mentioned that bit.
So Dave met Paul first before you, Maureen?
Yeah, I think, you knew him before I did, and then I got to know him
Okay. All right, so Dave, tell me about when you very first met him, when your first impressions.
We used to go out for drinks in Chawton, really, with Andy Hardy and Matt Carroll, and Paul was there. And my first impression was how quiet and sort of like held back Paul was. I'd kind of assumed that getting to know him he would be a louder man than he was, but he wasn't. He was very much not wanting to hug the limelight. And I remember one time we were in the Horse and Jockey in Chawton, and this bloke came up and he went, you're Paul Ryder, aren't you? And Paul, he was like, not embarrassed, but you know what I mean, he was like, yeah, and not in like an aloof way. And the lad said, do you mind if I have your autograph? And Paul sat dead self-conscious and signed it and everything. But then afterwards, I think he just felt nice, you know what I mean, that somebody had actually taken the effort to go and see him. But I get quite humble, I always found in that. Didn't like to show off, just had to get on with stuff.
And what about you, Maureen? What did you think when you first met him?
Again, quiet, how quiet and sort of reserved, and also how nice he smelled. It sounds always, no matter what the aftershave, it was always a really nice, clean, fresh smell. I think I remember that. Probably the nicest smelling smoker I've ever come across. And always was always very interested in me. So we would ask questions about what I was doing and how I was and my life and all that sort of thing. Not really talking about himself very much at all.
So there was a very special day that the two of you had that he was involved in. Do you want to tell me about that, Rory?
Yes, the day we got married. We'd been together for 7 years before we got married. And for one reason or another, neither one of us actually ever wanted a wedding. Wanted to be married, but never actually wanted a wedding. So we decided to effectively elope and not tell anyone that we were getting married, to just actually have the ceremony and then tell people afterwards. But what we wanted to do is find a way of actually memorialising it. So we needed two people to be witnesses, which was our friend Andy and his then partner Karen. And then we asked Paul if he would do a video of the whole day, so that if people wanted to have a look at it, they could. I know that Linda later told me how excited Paul was to actually be having this job, and took it very seriously, the job of a camera operator. Unfortunately, he managed to somehow record the very worst of us, didn't he? It really wasn't a good tape that came out, and there was far too much swearing and poor behaviour going on, so we couldn't actually ever show it to any of our relatives at all.
There wasn't 5 minutes we could salvage from it.
Even the actual ceremony itself was just punctuated by heckling.
Give it a fucking kiss.
By him and Andy all the way through.
I think that sounds like probably the most interesting wedding video of all time.
Maurice said we eloped. We eloped to Salford.
Yeah, it was in Salford. You know what I mean?
It wasn't like somewhere posh. It was only Salford registry office. And also as well, Paul, I think you're down to Paul because he needed another cigarette. But we're fashionably late as well. You know, it's supposed to be the bride. Me and Andy and Paul went to the pub beforehand. And then we got another drink and then another drink. And Paul had to get some cigarettes from the machine or something. So we ended up being fashionably late. So even before the filming started, he bore his stamp.
Did he manage to press go, though?
He did. He filmed the whole day. He was there the whole day. And we had gone for a meal in Barca afterwards. And everything was... But there was just nothing that could be used, because there was just this monologue going on in the background of every F word and C word and everything. Just awful. Just...
Him talking over
yes,
it, you
mean? He was talking over it. Andy was heckling as well. There was just, it was just awful.
And did he go there on the bus?
No, we picked him up. Me and Andy picked him up from Linda's. You think I would have let him get on a bus to me, wouldn't you?
You know what I mean? I just thought that was like part of the plan. Sorry.
And then the wedding night was also spoilt by Paul constantly ringing up, asking us if we were doing it yet, and just laughing his head off and putting the phone down.
So how long had you known Paul at that point, Dave?
Properly know him just since the Mondays went west, sort of the early 90s, I suppose.
Right, and what was going on in Paul's life at that point?
He was, I think, drifting.
It was the back end of the time he was with Estrella, wasn't it?
I don't think he knew what to do, to be honest. That was my impression. Gaz was knocking about then as well. Gaz was always there, I think, for Paul then.
Jacob and Millie would have been very young then, weren't they? They were still very young kids.
Yeah, and me and my son and Paul and Jacob went to a few festivals and things, and Paul sort of still... fascinated with the whole music thing, not to be a star, but just the whole sort of culture of the music. So I think maybe he missed that and he was looking for something to do. And then he set up Buffalo 66 with Gaz, and I used to DJ for them at the start of their shows, Band of the Wall and things.
Disco Dave!
And then there was all the Big Arm stuff. There was a story which I told to you and Ian Brown at Paul's funeral, about the time when I seen Derek and Linda be the most proud of Paul. And it was when Paul was fronting Big Arm and Ian Brown asked him to play and support him at the G-Mex. And Paul was like really, really nervous about this, and he didn't know whether he could go through with it and everything, because it was him. He was fronting Big Arm. He was doing it clean. There was 8,000 people there, and Ian Brown was like really wanting him to do it. And a couple of days before... Paul was saying to him, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can. And Linda and Derek were saying, yeah, of course you can. Amelia was there at the concert, and I think that's the most nervous I've seen him. And he got up on stage and he killed it. It was brilliant. You know, he got up and he was singing and he was like the front man that you'd like never
yeah,
seen.
Yeah, it was the right transformation.
And he was like, everyone was in, it was in the arena then, so there was thousands of people there. And he came off stage and I was at the back with Derek and Linda and Paul was like, he could see he was trying to keep how proud he was to himself. But Derek and Linda, they were glowing. They were, because there's been a kind of lively time with Paul when he was younger, and this was just straight Paul, just doing this stuff, having the confidence to do it, and just being dead good as well. And Derek and Linda were so proud.
Going back in time, shortly after you met him, he gave you a kind of job, didn't he? When he was still in the Mondays. Tell me about that.
Paul had to have some encouragement to go on the tour because it wasn't going to happen if Paul wasn't going to do it.
So we're going back to... This would be in 2000, would it?
I'll tell you exactly when it was. It was spring 1999. Right, and the reason I know it was then is because while you were away was when I found out I was pregnant.
A little bit before that, Paul got a phone call from Huey from the Fun Loving Criminals, who said that he was playing a gig in Parr Hall in Warrington and would Paul go along to see him. So Paul said, do you want to come and see the Fun Loving Criminals? So I said, yeah, okay. And when we were there, this bloke came up to Paul, I didn't know him from Adam, and said, oh, hiya Paul, I've been wanting to have a word with you. And he's a guy called Simon Rand, sorry. And he said, I really want to get the Mondays back together again. And you'll be brilliant. And Paul went back and he said, oh, I can't, I don't think I can do that. But I said, from what I know, the rest of them said, well, it's not going to happen if Paul's not going to do it. The issue was whether, going on tour, there would be temptations. So he asked me to go along just to make sure that he stayed on the straight and narrow. And we ended up going on tour, and my job was really to keep away from Sean, to make sure the door was locked so nobody knocked on his door, trying to lead him astray at the night. And that was pretty much my role there.
And how good was he at staying on the straight and narrow? Did he test you much?
I think Paul was doing his best.
Do you think that it was a really difficult situation for him to put himself into, given his history? Like, do you think it was like a no-win type situation, or was there a chance that he'd be able to pull it off and
I don't know what he was thinking. At first, I think I maybe naively thought, he's only going to do it if he can do it straight. He's been through so much shit, he's not going to go back there. But then I thought, well, is that realistic to think that?
I think there was a part where he genuinely thought, oh no, it'll be all right. But I'm not surprised that it wasn't. It just, he's not really ever been a person that was particularly resilient in terms of those temptations. And I can just imagine the pressure of, because it was the first real big comeback, wasn't it, with the whole original, well, it was mostly the original lineup there. And that was a massive, massive test. And I think that you were asked to do a job that was actually quite an impossible one.
Yeah.
I think at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was still drinking at the time. It was mainly just to stop him from taking drugs. And subsequently he learned that you can't really drink if you're a drug addict. Like, you have to stop everything. And I think perhaps that was part of what the battle was for him. Tell about the story about you giving Dave a call and saying you've got to...
Yes. It was about partway through the tour and I did a test and realised that I was pregnant. And then I was trying to ring David and not answering the phone for a couple of days, which is not typical, is not at all unusual. And I was getting myself really worked up in a sort of a hormonal frenzy, I suppose. And was it a voicemail or did I actually speak to your face?
No, you spoke to me. I remember where it was. It was
you need to get home now. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care about... You need to get home now. And you just dropped everything and came along, didn't you?
Yeah, Paul said to me, what was that about? I said, I've no idea. It's just most going bananas. And he said, why? I said, I don't know. She just said, I've got to go home. Yeah, what do you mean you've got to go home? He said, you're supposed to be here for another 2 weeks. And I said, I don't know, but she sounded like she meant it. And I said, look, I'm just going to have to go. And I went back and then found out the news that Maureen's pregnant.
I actually don't think I expected you to actually come home. I shout, you know, when you say these things when I was in a frenzy. I didn't. I was actually surprised that you did.
What happened
there was a period where he was going and scoring, but living with Derek and Linda as well, and trying to keep it quiet from them, and they're not daft. They knew what was going on. He was at home pretty much most of the time. And me and Mo used to go to the pub with him on a Sunday dinner to the Barton Arms, just down from where you lived. But that was pretty much it. He was sleeping all the time, he was in his room.
It was very obvious, I think, and the thing that was frustrating for us, sorry to cut you off, was that the frustrating thing was that he thought that he was fooling people.
Yeah.
That was the thing that was frustrating, and it was almost like,
yeah,
don't insult my intelligence. You're going to have to work harder than that if you want to fool me. I think that was the thing that was a frustration, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he kept it, and he tried to keep it quiet from everybody, do you know what I mean? I remember one time he just got bizarre. I think he kind of lost a bit of perspective. Like, there was one time I went down there, and he said, do you want this coat? I went, what do you mean, do you want this coat? And he goes, oh, I got it for a video shoot. I don't want it anymore. So I said, well, I don't need a coat. And he goes, here, just take, yeah, have it. And then about 20 minutes later, he went, I'd say, you couldn't have 10 quid, could you? And I thought, you didn't think I'm daft? You're just trying to sweep me up and then sting me for a tenner. No, I didn't actually. And then he said, he was like, a bit sulky and everything. I said, you can't put me in that position. I would have preferred it if he'd have said, look, I'm so desperate. When drugs are the life, it distorts the way you are, from what I've seen with Paul anyway.
Yeah. There was a thing with the records as well, wasn't there, remember? When he was DJing for a bit.
He wasn't getting out of the house, and I was DJing all the time in Manchester then. And I said, look, I said, why don't you just go out and DJ? I said, at least you're doing something with music and you're getting out of the house and everything. And he went, oh, I've got no records, I don't know how to do that. I know the people in the clubs. I said, I'll take you, I'll get you a bit of expenses. I said, I've got a load of records. It's just to try and give you a bit of something. And they thought, this went, the first couple of times it was okay. I think the third time, we were on Oxford Road, and we'd finished doing this gig, and I said, do you want to go for a pizza or something? And he went, well, have you got some money for a pizza? And I went, yeah, yeah. And he said, oh, you could get stoned for that. And then there was one time when he met some lad, I don't even know who he was, but Paul knew him from the old days or something. And we dropped off this lad in Salford somewhere. Then I dropped off Paul. And I got home and I thought, where have my records gone? Because I had a bag of records and they weren't in the car. I thought, oh, for God's sake. So I went back to the venue the next day and I said, look, I've left my records here. And the bloke said, well, there was no records here last night. And I spoke to Paul and I said, I've only gone and left me records in that place. And he just went, and then I went back and saw the manager and I said, look, I said, they must have been there, they were in the booth. And the bloke goes, I swear they weren't there. And it was only ages and ages afterwards Paul confessed. And I think he was only doing 12 steps.
It was
steps
his 12 steps, wasn't it?
And he actually said to me, and he was dead upset telling me.
So what had he done? He'd just stolen them all and sold
what
them?
I said, tell me exactly what happens if you're going to do it. And Paul sold the lad my bag of records. But yeah, it's quite raw when things like that happen.
And there was a time, shortly after I met Paul, actually, that unbeknownst to me, he relapsed. And this was while we were still living separately. And Dave and Andy, who's another really good friend of Paul's, felt like they had to step in.
There was a time when me and Paul had an intervention.
Intervention?
Me and Andrew were getting increasingly concerned about Paul. It was quite clear that he was losing it. He was in the middle of somewhere not very good. So we said, look, it's going to be an awful thing to do, but let's go down and confront him face to face and tell him exactly that we know exactly what's going on and make him face up to things. We'd never done this before. We're not Jerry Springer or anything. So we went down. It was at Linda's, and it was a Sunday afternoon. Linda had to wrench him out of bed, and he came down. And we sat him down in the back kitchen and just told him, you know, we're close mates. You know, you're going nowhere. You're not kidding anyone. You've got to do something. You know, why? And just put it all out. And he was in tears. It hit him hard. And me and Andy were devastated afterwards. We went away, not even convinced it would do any good. We tried.
I think you said, if you don't tell Angela, I will. That's what he told me when we were in Dublin, because he was frightened that you would tell me, I think. But the next few years when we lived in Worsley, he was kind of in and out. He was trying all the time, which is the reason that I stayed with him, is because I knew that he genuinely wanted to be clean, but he just kept falling off the wagon, getting back on, falling back off. 9 years of that before we moved to America, when he finally did manage to get a long amount of clean time in. But during those times, it was. Let's talk about some good things. What do you remember from that time?
I've actually got one memory, which might not seem like it was funny, but it was the only time I ever saw Paul annoyed. We were in a bar in town. It was like a Sunday afternoon. It was dead. There was hardly anyone around. And there was a crew there filming this clearly boy band. It wasn't anyone that anyone knew, but there was this boy band that were doing some filming, and we were just sort of sat to the side. And this woman comes up with a clipboard, and she goes like, "Mr. Puss, excuse me, are you with Alive?" The band was called Alive, apparently. He bristled. He actually, "Alive? What do you mean?" And all through the afternoon, he just, "Can you believe that, man? Alive? Can you believe that? Are you with Alive?" And he just every so often, he just kept going, "Are you with Alive?" Right, to punctuate. He was so indignant. And that's the nearest I ever saw Paul to actually losing his temper. The thought of him being in a boy band.
I've got a couple of nice memories to counterbalance the other ones. The first one was we'd been to a festival and we were coming back in the early hours of the morning, and we got as far as Birch Services, which, as you know, is only about 20 minutes from home. And Paul said, "Oh, I've got to stop. I've only got a couple of cigs left." I said, "You're going to be home in 20 minutes?" And he said, "No, I'll just nip in here for 40. So we pulled into Birch Services and I noticed a bit of steam coming out the front of his car. Anyway, he went in and got his cigs. And he went, "Oh, you're not going to believe it. That bloke in there recognised me." And I said, "I believe you." Anyway, we got in the car, and as soon as he turned it on, all this steam started coming out of the bonnet. And he knew from his GPO driving days that the radiator had a leak in it. And so we were up on the moors, and he said, "I can fix it." And so he went into the petrol station again and came out with a dozen eggs. And he said, "There's this trick you can use, where if you put eggs in a radiator, it'll just completely sort out your mechanical problems in your car." And so we were there. I think he got through about three or four cigarettes on the forecourt of the blooming petrol station while his car was cooling down. And then we're there cracking these eggs and putting them all in. And I just thought, it fixed it, managed to get back at everything. And I just thought, that bloke, when he got home from work that morning, his wife or whoever said, "How was work tonight?" And he went, "You're not going to believe this. Paul Ryder came in and bought a dozen eggs off me at 2 o'clock in the morning." Me and Mo were talking about this the other day because Moyne found a photograph, which I didn't even know existed, of Paul. And he's got my blue swimming goggles on. And we went to the Leeds Festival, and we're in the backstage area, and there's a big marquee at where the artists go to have something to eat. And me and Paul went in there, and there was only me and Paul in. And so we were just having our food, and Paul said, what have you got in your bag there? You know, I always carry my rucksack with me. So I said, "I don't know." And I looked in it, and I had my swimming goggles in there, my blue swimming goggles. And I think I for some reason I'd been for a swim before the festival or something. Anyway, I happened to have my blue swimming goggles in. And Paul goes, "Oh, they're mega, let's have a go." I said, "Have a go." And he goes, "Yeah." So he put these blue swimming goggles on, and we were having our food. And in fact, Mo's got this photograph.
Looks like Cosmo Smallpiece.
Which I hadn't seen. I honestly hadn't seen this photograph. Didn't know it existed. I hadn't seen it for, like, you know, till about 3 days ago. Anyway, this bloke comes across, and he sits, there's these long benches, and he sits there, and he's looking across at Paul and laughing and giggling at the fact that Paul's got these glasses on and everything. And it was Marilyn Manson, and he was, like, sat there, and he was having his fit then. Paul took the goggles off, and we went to the stage to watch someone. And we'd only been gone 2 or 3 minutes, and I said, "Oh, left me swimming goggles at the marquee." So I said, "Just wait there, I'll just go back and get them." Anyway, got back, and my swimming goggles had gone. And Marilyn Manson had gone. And so I went to the woman who served us and said, "Excuse me," I said, "did you find any swimming goggles on the bench?" And she went, oh, no. And I said, are you sure? Because I left them on there. I said, there was someone sat in. And she said, well, he left a few minutes after you. And so Marilyn Manson went, and my swimming goggles went as well.
We're not accusing.
Me and Paul are convinced to this day. Paul said, it's that Manson. I'm going to find him, get your goggles back. Paul's incensed. There's loads and loads of just dead nice stories. And also, as well, you'll know, one of the lovely things about spending time with Paul is just the stories that he just dropped in to conversations about people that he met and people that he knew. And everyone said to him, I said, who's the best person you've met? You know your pop star days and everything. And he goes, well, easy, Roy Wood. Remember Roy Wood in Wizard? Paul said, he's brilliant. He said, I've met him before now. He said, he's a right laugh. He said, he's everything you'd want company to be. He said, he was great. He said, Roy Wood, bar none.
Move away, Bowie. Move away, Mick Jagger. Yeah. Roy Wood.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
He told us about going to, when he went to Brazil, they were playing at that big stadium and they got a chance to go and visit Ronnie Biggs. And he said, we went up there and we just went to meet him and you know, sit by his pool. And he just ended up staying there for ages. And then he went on to the next bit of conversation about how he likes Holt's beer and everything. But this was it. You didn't know whether he was going to talk about loving fried eggs, needing to go and get some money for some cigarettes, or sitting by a swimming pool with Ronnie Biggs, or having a laugh with Roy Wood. And I think that was the sort of enduring memory about Paul, is that it was just this kaleidoscope of seemingly random, but all, I've no doubt, all dead true. I was at his house one time, and he said, just a minute, he's on the phone and everything. He said, yeah, all right then. And put the phone down. I said, who was that? And he goes, oh, it's Robbie Williams. And you did, just in passing, you know. And whereas any one of these little things to people who are not in that world seemed like a big deal. Mm. But they were, I don't know, I think so many people liked Paul because he was just nice. You know what I mean? Just nice. And I think, you know, more than anyone, you know, it's nice.
I used to get plagued every so often from Paul because you know how Paul has a nickname for everyone. I'm second line Mo because... Second line,
no, not what you think.
Not what you think. Second, because he always claimed that no matter what song it was, if he said a line to me, I always knew the next line. And that he would every so often just randomly test me by sort of recalling these sort of obscure funk and soul records and saying a line of them and go on and see if I would come back with the line. And I think I mostly did, but yeah, I got the nickname Second Line Mo for my knowledge of obscure soul and funk lyrics.
And because he had a really broad view of music and likes all sorts of stuff, he used to try and catch you out, didn't he? So one time it'd be something like Isaac Hayes. And then the next time it'd be The Sweet or someone like that to try and catch my heart. And the reason why I call me Disco Dave, we're in Glasgow and this couple came across and said, oh, excuse me, can we have your autograph? And Paul just smiled and I said, yeah, of course you can. And so he said, okay. And he gave this piece of paper, but he gave it to me. And I said, do you mean Paul will sign it for you? And he went, No, it's for you. And I went, me? I said, who do you think I am? And this lad goes, yeah. I said, who the hell does he think I am? And so they said, we've come all the way from Aberdeen to see you. I said, what the fuck are you talking about? We booked in last night and you're on tomorrow. So we've got tickets and everything. He said, here's a flyer. And he come to some club night and the lead DJ was called Disco Dave. I thought...
It's because they'd said to you originally, you're Dave, aren't you? And you said, yeah, because you are.
So I signed it. Didn't want Paul's autograph. But my, so I signed it Disco Dave, and that's where it came from.
Were you into the Mondays, like in the early days? Was it a thing? Were you part of that scene, both of you?
Yeah, the records that Paul got the money for were all like early Mondays releases and everything.
Didn't Paul give your kid a tape of like when they very, very, very first started playing together and they're both at the post office?
Yeah. I don't know where that happened.
I know what happened to it. You told me, your kid told me what he did to it.
What did he say?
He taped a Def Leppard album over it. Can you believe that? It was like one of the, they'd been like only been rehearsing for like a matter of weeks. And Paul gave, David's brother's also called Paul. So Paul gave Paul, like, it's a tape of me and my new band. And he taped a Def Leppard album over it. He still regrets that to this day.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it, how things would have been different if he'd not been an addict. Like, if that hadn't been an issue for him, how different his life maybe not. I don't know. But it certainly was a massive impediment to him. I think he could have achieved a lot more than he did if he hadn't been legged down with all of that. And
I don't think he gets the recognition for being such a brilliant bass player as well. You know, he was a fantastic bass player. Well, the images of Paul was not about being an accomplished bass player as it should be. It was all about the hedonism and all that kind of stuff. One time when he was in a bad way and he was at Derek and Linda's, and Derek was saying, you've not played your guitar for years, but you don't even know where it is and everything. And he brought his bass downstairs and he picked it up. Like, bear in mind, he'd been in some bad places, hadn't played it for years.
When he was like James Anderton?
Yeah, he had a great big beard at the time. Before anyone had beards, Paul had this great big beard.
It was the James Anderton years.
Because he said water hurt his face and he used to put a load of weight. He was fat, he had a big beard and everything. And he picks up this guitar and I just thought, God, this is superb. He just picked it up and played this solo and he was, with bits of chic riffs in it and all kinds of stuff, and I thought, whoa, just did it. I think Derek goaded him, and I think it was as much to show Derek, really. You know, he wasn't showing off. It was like to
do you not think that is exactly what Derek wanted to have happen? Of course it was. He was obviously just saying, look, and so he was taking the opportunity of you being there to say, I want you to get back in touch with what you do, really.
A few people have said to me what a brilliant bass player, and the combination of him and Gaz, the drummer and bass. And I was saying, about how do you go about writing your records, songs? And he said, basically, me and him and Gaz, because they know each other, they instinctively knew how to play together. Tony Wilson described him as Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare once. That important as a sort of a drum and bass backbone to the band. I said, you've got these albums. I said, there must be loads of other stuff that you've never used. And he goes, no, he said, we'd start off and we'd just stick with that until it became a song, and then we'd use it. We just did it until it was a song.
How did you feel when you moved to LA? Do you think that was a good idea?
I'll be blunt, yes, because he was with you. Get away from it, go somewhere else. I don't think that you would have had that happen if there wasn't a real sense of this is now where it's going to have to be different.
If he was living in Manchester, or indeed anywhere in England, he would always have been in an environment where he would have come into contact with drugs. And one way or another, I don't think he would ever have got away from drugs if he didn't actually leave the country.
He used to say, well, when he goes to meetings, people recognise him and he couldn't properly anonymous. And I get that. And also, living in Manchester in particular, he knew where to go. He had connections, so it's just harder. It's a bit like not being able to eat sugar but having loads of sweets in your cupboard. Mm-hmm. It's like they say, if you stay in a barber's shop long enough, you'll end up with a haircut. It was a bit like that. And I know a lot of people do manage to get clean, stay clean and be in the same place. But it's a harder struggle, I think.
Yeah, but there's not many people who have the setup that Paul had, though, is there? There's not many people who... He'd almost be people falling over themselves to be the ones that are giving him drugs or out partying, or because he was someone to be seen with. So the temptation just for anybody who's an addict is one thing, but having that on top of, layered on top of that, in Manchester especially, that's, it would have been impossible.
I mean, I saw it in the times I spent with him, and it's quite clear people wanted him to give, to take drugs with them.
When he was in LA, did he keep in touch with you? Did you see him over the years?
Yeah, it's one of those things that you physically move from someone and then you meet them and you pick up where you left off.
Yeah.
And not long before he died, me and Paul and Andy were having, went for a drink. It wasn't that long before he died, and he gave me a lift home, and we were just having a chat, and we were talking about when he used to go on tour, and he used to love buying clothes, not necessarily the most expensive clothes or the show, just buying clothes,
especially the reduced at TK Maxx.
Absolutely,
yeah. There was a place that opened in some retail park called Eisenhower, it was called, and it was like a kind of pretend outdoor shop, and it was just puffer jackets that used to let him walk and this kind of stuff, but they were a bit flashy and they were little one-offs and everything, and he used to say, let's go to Eisenhower again, you know, and he used to go into things he didn't even need, you know what I mean, but just like going and buying a, you know, coats and wear a couple of times.
And was that the last time that you saw him?
Yeah, when he drove me home that time, yeah. And I came in, because we left early, about 10 o'clock, and I was saying to Mo, I said, oh, it's really on form, Paul. You know, he was, he looked fresh, and he was funny, and, you know, we were just chatting like you would want him to be. That's why, in one way, it was such a big shock when he died.
How did you find out that he died?
It was that afternoon.
I'd just come home from school. So it would have been about 5 o'clock.
Yeah, and then it started being on the news and that kind of thing.
And what did you feel?
It didn't seem real. Because it was like... Because you'd always thought, you know, Paul's not the healthiest of blokes, you know what I mean? He don't go to the gym. He's the world champion smoker. And the amount of drugs he's consumed and alcohol he's drunk. He was never going to get a telegram from the Queen or anything. But it still was painfully young. You still, even though you think people are not that healthy, or you assume they're not, but you don't equate that with thinking they're going to die soon.
And I think the shock was compounded by the fact that they were so obviously gearing up for an active phase with the Mondays again, do you know what I mean? It was that things were happening, so you don't equate that with, oh, actually, this is now suddenly going to be over. You know, I thought that if it did happen, it would obviously be during a time where he was obviously down. Do you know what I mean? And I'll be honest with you, one of the biggest things that I thought, obviously before we found out, got the information about how he died, was like, please don't let it be.
Yeah.
Please don't let it be something that people are going to draw a horrible conclusion about who he is from. You know what I mean? Don't let it be self-inflicted in any way. Please don't. And that was the thing that I just had in my, as soon as I heard, or not long after, oh no, please don't. And then you sort of became very hyper-vigilant for what people might be saying.
Well, there were two things. There was that, and then there was, I didn't want it to have been a drug related.
Yes.
But at least I feel like he's gone with some dignity.
Yes, that was it. I think that's the word, dignity. That was the thing that I was really conscious of, is that I wanted him to have his dignity, and I wanted Linda to have hers as well, and the kids. I wanted everybody to still be able to have their dignity and be free to mourn and grieve without the intrusion of people who really don't know what they're talking about.
And I think anybody in the public eye who dies, especially if they die of drugs, that's what people remember. You know, they don't remember, you know, everything before. They just remember that, you know, that last hour when the drugs didn't work anymore.
And just for those of you that don't know, the coroner's report said that Paul passed away as a result of ischemic heart disease and diabetes.
What did you think of the funeral?
I thought it was just right. I think it was It was what Paul would have wanted.
I would have absolutely loved it, but would have actually hated it at the same time, because he wouldn't have wanted to be the centre of attention, but would have loved being there.
No, Paul would have gone.
He would have been shuffling around at the back,
Paul would have gone to the funeral. he'd have turned up, and then halfway through, he'd have gone, sat in his car, had a few cigarettes, and probably gone home early.
He went home early from Derek's funeral, didn't he?
Yeah.
He turned around to me and said, "I don't like functions," and just left.
but
I remember Gaz being incensed. Functions? It's your dad's funeral. What are you saying function for?
But I think that it's nice that, that people who obviously cared about him, you know, all made the time to. And and it was very... Everybody in the place, obviously, were close to Paul.
Tell the people were there.
Family and friends and people that he'd known through work. And that's what he used to say to me sometimes. When he was on tour, he said, "Oh, I've got work tomorrow." And he used to still refer to it in the same terms as like being in the post office. "Oh, I'm on in an hour." But yeah, I think he would have... I think it would have been the funeral that Paul would have wanted, I think.
Mm.
Yeah. Remember, Paul said that one of the bad things about being in the public eye, having a degree of fame and everything, is actually developing new friendships. Because you don't know whether it's somebody who wants to know you because you're the Happy Mondays, or whether it's somebody who is interested in you generally as a person. A friend of ours, unfortunately, died years ago, and we get together once a year. Just like the lads that we've all known each other for years and everything. And I always thought Paul was quite relaxed in that, because people aren't there because he can play guitar. They're just there because we just know him. Even then, in this pub, and it was a back street pub on the side of a railway side in Eccles, and we were in there. There was me, Andy, and about three or four other lads, and we were all there to remember Barry, our friend who died. And the only two people in the pub were these two lads, and they must have only been in their 20s in the back room, and I just noticed them when I went to the toilet. Anyway... later on the evening, the barman came across, said, "Excuse me," he said, "that man that was just in there, was that Paul Ryder out there after Mondays?" And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "Those two young lads in there saw him go to the toilet." Now, they had no reason to think why Paul might be there. And yet, for people who were maybe not even born when Paul was the thing, and they just recognised him in this random pub. And that kind of shows that he is ingrained in the place.
And it shows as well how difficult it was for him to live in Manchester as well, if he's trying to, like, be clean and not be that...
I remember there was one time when we took him to the Barton Arms. This was during when he was in quite a bad way, when we used to take him once a week. And what's his name was in there? A young Ryan Giggs, can you remember? And he'd not long started playing for United, Ryan Giggs. And he was in there. As we were leaving... Ryan Giggs was sort of sat around at the side with his mates, and it struck me, because Ryan Giggs, who at the time was like class of 92, he'd already won the Premier, and he was going, "That's Paul Ryder, that's Paul," and he was like proper fangirling over the fact that he'd seen Paul Ryder. And it's like, God, Jerry actually is famous, isn't he? You know what I mean? Because he was just Paul. He wasn't anything else. And it was really... I was really taken aback by the fact that someone as famous as Ryan Giggs was starstruck by seeing Paul Ryder. It was bizarre.
Did Paul notice it?
No.
No,
it was... I saw it, and I told him afterwards, and I was gutted. He was like, "Oh, should I go back in? Should I go back in?" But he didn't go back in. He just wanted to get home, I think, by that time.
You know, these stories that he used to come out with and just drop them in, and he just said to me, "That David Beckham's a nuisance." And I said, "Why is that?" And he goes, "He keeps kicking the ball into our back garden." And well, what? Because you know where Derek and Linda lived in Worsley? You know, David Beckham lived back-to-back, didn't they? It was like his first house, and then new houses just in the cul-de-sac. Yeah. And he used to kick the ball. He was only youngish at United then. He used to kick the ball about, and Paul was saying, "He's always kicking the ball. This ball keeps coming over. I keep throwing it back and everything." And then he said, "I saw that his girlfriend, Victoria Spice, as well. She was sat on the wall outside the off-licence." She said, David Beckham had gone to this off-licence, and she was sat out on the wall, and Paul said to her something like, he said, "Have you got no home to go to," or something like that. Yeah, she just sat.
No, do you know what it was? It was because he had the dog with him, Bella, the dog. Paul had his dog, Bella. Do you remember Bella, the sheep dog?
Yeah.
And she was messing with... He'd tied the dog up and gone in the shop, and he came out, and she was messing with Bella. And he said, "Will you leave me dog alone?" He told her for messing with the dog. It was just always sort of in the background somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Paul was always just part of our lives in and out, and sometimes you saw him, sometimes you didn't, and you'd get a message every so often. But it was always, I always smiled when I saw him. Do you know what I mean? Whenever I saw Paul, it was, oh, it's Paul, and it was always a nice to see him and nice to catch up, and it's just a shame that we're not going to be able to do that anymore.
Yeah, I used to get random texts from him, which also, as I said, always said, "How are you for light bulbs?" Because, yeah, do you know? Because I don't know whether I had some kind of issue with light bulbs, but I invariably had been buying light bulbs when I saw him and went, and he said, "Have you been on light bulbs again?" And he just happened, to be buying light bulbs. And then for years afterwards, he used to send me texts, "You all right for light bulbs?" Just out of the blue.
The other one he always used to do is he'd send us, "Do you want an egg with that?"
Yeah.
Oh, so, because I told him the story of how when I first met my our mother-in-law and first went over to dinner, she made me the most random meal I've ever had in my life, which was cheese and tomato pizza, boiled potatoes and Brussels sprouts. And she just went, "Do you want an egg with that?" And we told him that, and for the next 25 years, every so often, there'd just be a text going, "Do you want an egg with that?" It really tickled him.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
That's all we've got for you this week. We're playing out with a track that Paul did with his ex-girlfriend, Donovan's daughter, Estrella Leach, and his Big Arm collaborator and friend, Pete Smith. It's called Let It Flow, and I love her voice so much. We're going to be back again next week, same time, same place, with another bonus episode. And if you'd like to watch this episode on video, it's going to be premiering next Sunday at 8 p.m. UK time. That will be the 7th of April on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, Glistening Stories, at 8 p.m. UK time. And I'm going to be live in the chat with Chico as usual. So please, if you've not already reviewed and rated this podcast, please give us a nice review and rating. It really, really helps. Oh, sorry, that's my phone going. Please spread the word, tell your friends about it, and please join our Patrons Club by going to patreon.com/ The Paul Ryder Tapes. Patrons get first dibs on being in our live streams, and we've got another one coming up very soon, so please don't miss out. Have a really brilliant week, everybody. Big thanks to all of you for being here. Especially big thanks to Disco Dave and Second Line Mo for talking to us this week. And thanks, of course, as usual, to the man himself, who's the inspiration behind all of this, the late and the great Paul Anthony Ryder. See you next week. Bye. Gotta go.
let it flow.